Doing our top 10 favorite episodes of Avatar The Last Airbender here. So I guess we're going to go around, go from bottom to the top here, each give it, discuss our episodes. So I got my list up. I got Nick's list is here. Tim, you got your episodes already there?
Yep.
All right. Very good. So I'm going to start and then I'm going to go around here. So, my number 10 episode for my favorite episode of Avatar Last Airbender will be the Ember Island Players. Really like it a lot. This is the episode where they kind of get meta with Avatar Last Airbender here. They kind of poke fun at the fan base, poke fun at the characters, in reference to a lot of things here. And if you actually know a lot about like the behind-the-scenes stuff of Avatar Last Airbender, it kind of makes jokes about what kind of went on behind the scenes in the writer's room. Like, for instance, Toph was originally supposed to be a man and not a girl. Mm-hmm. But that opinion was changed there. Also, the whole relationship between Zuko and Katara. Zutara was a big ship that a lot of the fans wanted. That the writers did seriously consider at one moment. The creators actually did seriously consider that, but then pivoted away from that. Obviously, at the end of the show, Aang ended up with Katara. Are any of you big Zutara shippers? Were you that at the time when you were kids or anything like that? No.
Let me think. Hell no.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, Mike Hedgewood, I think, had a good opinion on it. Of like kind of a lot of the relationships. She is. Yeah. Big Zutara shipper there. A lot of girls liked Zuko back in the day. A lot of girls had it for Zuko. I mean, I don't know. Mike Hedgewood, he had a good opinion on it.
Rewatching the show, I kind of get it.
Yeah. He had a good opinion where he was kind of like all the relationships in the show are kind of basic. It's like, okay, people kind of end up who you expect them to end up with. You know, Zuko ended up with Mei, Aang ended up with Katara. Of course, the main character is going to end up with the main girl of the show. So it kind of all was kind of predictable in that sense. Rain from Trudy's,
Sokka ended up with everybody.
Yeah. Which I think, Tim, since you've read the books and the extended stuff, so was it that Zuko ended up marrying Mei and had kids with Mei, or did he do it with somebody else? Because that was never really like kind of clear, was it?
Mei, they do get together, but I am struggling to remember if they did. But I do know that they do break up shortly after his coronation because he keeps disregarding her opinion, and that's something that is very just something that she can't have done because that was something that was done consistently by Azula. And she likens him to her sister or to a sister and kind of leaves. And she's actually not present for the bulk of the comics.
Okay. And then Sokka, did he stay with Suki or?
Yes. That's something that's not really addressed really because in Legend of Korra, we don't see anything about Suki. And we don't see anything about them having kids or anything like that. But Sokka and Suki they were together the whole time, as far as I know.
I really like this episode. I thought it was, really good humor. The show could be really funny. That was also another thing. The show really was good at comedy, really funny there. So they balanced that really well, which I think the live action, both the live action versions kind of miss that. They don't really have the same level of comedy that the cartoon does. I thought it was really nice. And it really, it's a good kind of recap type episode there that a lot of shows try to do. And this one's the best at doing it.
Yeah, it's like you're coming to the end to the series finale of your show. And I think traditionally a lot of series, they do kind of have that penultimate episode of, okay, this is like where we came from and here we are now.
Yeah.
And going back and kind of revisiting a lot of who these characters were at this point in time, I think is a great storytelling tool just to show have a visual representation of their character development in their face. I think is a great storytelling tool.
All right. Nick, what about you? What you got?
Okay. My number 10, I think, is a very underrated episode of The Last Airbender, and that's The Beach. That's, Zuko, Azula, Ty Lee, Mei, they all get forced to go visit their family's vacation house on Ember Island, and they have their own little kind of Stand By Me episode and misadventures. And for as heavy as the show is and how much it is dealing with these kids are basically forced into becoming essentially child soldiers, it's nice to have them have an episode where it is just them being kids and having them go through a lot of the same things that teenagers do, having that conflict with your girlfriend, having that kind of awkward interaction around boys, especially with the character Azula, and have this incredibly, I think, very emotional breakdown that Zuko has in this final episode, because at this point he's kind of living that lie of being the perfect prince to his father, and him dealing with that internal conflict, I think, is the absolute highlight of book three, even if I'm not crazy about that season as a whole in retrospect.
Yeah, and I love the kind of the closing moments of the episode here, when this scene right here, where they're just all like just unloading their trauma.
It's beautiful. And you have even moments with a character like Azula, who is the most sociopathic member of this entire cast. And even she is capable of having empathy for Zuko in this moment.
Yeah. What's your thoughts on this episode, Tim?
I thought it was that this is actually my number 10 as well, because this really is a point where you see the enemy humanized. You see Azula actually personified into an actual person instead of kind of someone who's psychopathic, and more like you can kind of separate her as just a villain without emotions. But you see that she is the culmination of a childhood where the last 3 years she had to be without Zuko, and she was the full expectation for the future of her country. And her mother played favoritisms with Zuko, and she never could figure out why her mom didn't love her. And you see these pieces of human emotion be applied to her, and it's really fun to watch. But you also see her trying to just be a normal teenager and absolutely fail at it when she's perfect in everything else.
To a hilarious degree. It's like, we'll be the most powerful couple in the universe. We'll dominate the earth.
And it goes a lot to show that the most evil family in the world was a family.
Yeah, they're the most sinister family you've ever met. Really. They are still people. Oh, yes.
And right from sure, I gotta have your anime style beach episode again. This is kind of another filler type episode a little bit, but it does good at expanding the characters, giving more background to them.
Yeah, with me, there are two kinds of story. There's plot driven, and there is character driven. And if either one of those is moving forward, then I can't really call it a filler episode. And this is much more of a character driven episode as far as story goes, because this is more about developing the internal conflict with Zuko, getting to humanize Azula, getting to humanize her trio throughout this, and even introducing kind of minor big bad with a Combustion Man as far as Aang story goes.
Since you both guys had the same number 10, I'll go to my number 9 here. Which for me would also be The Beach. I'm going to move on to number 8 for me. Well, actually, since my number 9 is Beach, I'll let you guys go. Nick, what's your number 9 there? Oh, did he freeze?
Number 9 is when, you know, Avatar The Last Airbender got scary for a minute, and that was a Puppet Master.
You're kind of breaking up a little bit there, Nick.
Shit, are we frozen?
Yeah, you're kind of frozen there. A little bit. Yeah, you're moving kind of slow. Yeah, okay. I think you're good now.
All right, I'm good.
Yeah, try it.
All right, so So my number 9 episode is when Avatar got scary as fuck, and that is an episode from book 3. This is Aang and the gang hearing whispers about people disappearing this all day. meet this old woman who's a waterbender who has much lessons to teach Katara. And this is the episode where we discover bloodbending and how, and for as much as the show is about kind of the horrors of war, we are seeing somebody who was a prisoner of war and seeing how much that has scarred and changed her and turned her cruel, because she is, we got a character moment like this with Jet, but never to this terrifying a degree.
Yeah.
Even down to very, like the score of this episode, even down to the final conflict of it and Katara being forced to use bloodbending and how horrifying that is to her.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on this episode?
I thought I actually ranked this number 7 because I thought it was an exceptional episode. It's one where we hear about the destruction of the Southern Water Tribe, but that's just kind of lingering in the background as part of Katara's past. And we see a survivor of that genocide, of the last actual fully realized bender of the Southern Tribe. And we see the bitterness that she holds, and you see the brutality that was inflicted on her by the Fire Nation, and having to live in a prison where you're slowly watching your peers die one by one, seeing your people be extinguished from the world. I would absolutely understand that justification for why she would snap like that and just go to, like, you, she's a monster. But she is a monster you 100% sympathize with. And it's really compelling because you see Katara get that ability and the way it breaks her to use it like that. And it becomes even a catalyst for some of the, like the central stuff in Legend of Korra. So it's a really pivotal episode, I believe.
Yeah.
And something that is showcasing that, because she uses it in a later episode in the Southern Raiders, and it's almost the like callousness and cruelty with which she uses it. It shows that this is not where Katara is not in her right mind.
Yeah. Very strong episode. This is my number 8 episode right here. And how do you all feel about the character of Hama? You can kind of understand her reasoning behind this and kind of what she did. Do you think she went too far, you think, in her actions using bloodbending?
Absolutely, because she wasn't using the bloodbending against like soldiers. She wasn't using it against people that were like in the army who were fighting the war, who were using it against other innocents. She was doing this to this innocent small town which one of the strengths of Book 3 of was adding dimension and adding humanity to the everyday people of the Fire Nation. Like, not all of them are like Azula. Not all of them are like the Commander Zhao's that we've met in the show. They are just people trying to get by.
Yeah. I see that. What about you, Tim? You were going to say something?
Like one of the things in the Geneva Convention, or one of the things that constitutes a war crime is targeting a civilian population and retaliating against them for the actions of their government. And that, I think, is when you go and you're just kidnapping random civilians and villagers that are so far removed from the actions of their government, not only does it not help your movement anymore, but it also makes it harder for the people that do want an end to the conflict to bring about that end. And it's, intrinsically, I think she's very wrong.
Yeah. And you will see bloodbending come back and be an important thing in the sequel series, Legend of Korra. It is kind of wild that Katara learns how to bloodbend basically, I guess, in like, what, a week or a day or something like that. She basically learns how to do it that quick, but okay, that's fine. And out of all the kind of the different bending techniques that we see in the show, other than the traditional elements, bloodbending is probably the most horrific because it's like you really are controlling like a puppet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and how it's used, especially in because Aang and Sokka try to like come to the scene and help, but yeah, they get mind controlled, and this is right after another one of an episode that's in my honorable mentions with Sokka's master. So Sokka has like a deadly weapon now.
Mm, yeah. So that is kind of very scary, kind of how it's done. And I mean, there was a conversation of like, you know, if all the nations, if they went all to kind of war together, like, you know, what's the most powerful element, or what nation would be the strongest or the weakest? And like, the show does a great job of balancing, like, seeing all these different things, kind of mm-hmm. these elements can do, especially when she shows her Katara, what Hama shows Katara, what water can do. You know, like, you can get mm-hmm. water from the air and the plants and the trees and everything like that. You can gather that. And even your own saliva and sweat, which Katara does at one point in the series there. So they do a very good job at expanding the world of, you know, using the different elements and everything like that, which is nice. But yeah, this was a really, really great episode. And this was an episode, this was in book three of the series here. All right here. So Tim, what was your number 9?
Tales of Ba Sing Se for me. And this one was a really unique episode because they actually let the people responsible for voice acting the characters write or contribute to the writing of that of their respective scenes. And I think this one was also a very emotionally charged one, because this is where mm-hmm. we get Leaves on the Vine.
Yes, and even more emotionally charged because Mako Yomatsu, who was the voice of Iroh, he passed away from cancer a couple months before this episode aired. So you get this very beautiful, heartbreaking tribute to the actor during this.
And we don't, that's part of the reason Iroh's character wasn't as really present in season 3, or because he did have an understudy because they did know he was dying. But mm-hmm. also they didn't want it to feel like they were replacing him. Mm-hmm. And that's why we also have General Iroh because they're consistently doing references and homages to both his character, and the Leaves on the Vine is in a live action as well.
Yeah, it's a very brave thing for a show. Because we talked about this in our review of The Bear, where you can have an episode where you completely change and alter the structure of the entire show. And in this, it's going into just this kind of shonen, kind of like a day in the life episode, and splitting it up into this anthology. And something that, much like we were talking about with filler episodes earlier in this conversation, with the beach, how while this is ostensibly a filler episode, you also get the biggest truth bomb of the season, and that's Appa's in Ba Sing Se. It's something that we didn't know at that point.
And this episode's almost like a collection of other kind of mini episodes inside of it. You kind of get the whole like girls' day out there with Toph and Katara, where they get to kind of bond and get to, you know, have their moment there. You also have a little bit of a moment there with like Aang and him like finding a zoo there, in the city. Mm-hmm. You also had, you know, Sokka. He's always macking. He's always going to be finding some girls. He's always going to doing some.
That man is the last Riz bender.
Yeah, he's always going to be doing. He's always going to find someone.
And I think that one showcases his intelligence exceptionally well, because that's mm-hmm. one of the things that he's a smarter character than he's given credit for, just because he's oafish.
He's the comic relief character, but I think it's another episode I'll get into when I get to my honorable mentions, but it's like everybody kind of takes for granted how intelligent Sokka is.
And this is the, like, he's doing a haiku, you know, he's doing a haiku there.
He's doing a rap battle.
Yeah, you know, he's going back.
And thinks himself tall.
You're so smart with your fancy little words. This is not so hard.
Spent mastering the form, the style. None calls it easy.
I calls it easy. Like I paddle my canoe, I'll paddle yours too.
Oh, wow. You know, he's just, yeah, some dudes just got it. You know, Sokka's got it for sure. So, yeah. Really, really wonderful kind of episode here, there. You have a favorite segment of the episode there out of the ones there, Girls Day Out or Flying High Over Bonsai Bay? Or
It would be the Iroh segment for sure, because it embodies, yeah, I think, it's Iroh just going about his day and he's doing all of these immense kindnesses for other people. Mm-hmm. And then it's culminated by that end where you see why he does all these kindnesses for people. Because he can't do them for his son.
Yeah. Ray from Charity said they're still waiting for a Lord of the Rings adaptation when they show Frodo's rap battle there.
In time.
Oh,
right. Patience, my friend.
So did nine here. Eight Nick already did there with mine, which was the Puppet Master. So I'll go to Nick. What's your eighth one right there?
Okay. My number eight is kind of the mid-season finale of book three, and that's the Day of Black Sun. We've heard about the whole kind of end game for the episode, for the season, as we were told, was the solar eclipse, where we're gonna get the invasion of the Fire Nation, and it goes horrifically wrong. And it's kind of the Empire Strikes Back moment of our characters, where Ozai knew about the whole plan of the invasion and let them come, and it failed devastatingly. But you also have some fantastic character moments. You have Sokka first stumbling with the leading the invasion and then being forced to take charge after his father gets injured. And you have this beautiful confrontation of Zuko speaking with his father Ozai, confessing that, yeah, not only is the Avatar alive, I'm going to go help him. Fuck you.
Great, great episode in this one. Tim, what's your one?
I think this episode is phenomenal. This episode is a two-parter, but it's really one of the biggest game changers, because people thought this was going to be the finale when it was airing. Because it was also there was a I believe an airing delay of 8 months between the end of Day of Sun Black and then
Of Black Sun Part 2 in the Western Air Temple. There was like an 8 month delay, which in network TV is just, you know, hiatus.
But so a lot of people were just like, shit, was that the end? Because that's just how it is when you're not like back in the 2000s when not everyone was online. But it's I think this episode is really kind of formative, because like everyone was preparing, and we see this movement of all these disparate factions that we've met up until now. And when we inevitably do get to the ending series or Sozin's Comet, but I'll talk about that later, but it's kind of fun how they subvert expectations by giving us this episode where they lose.
Yeah, the Empire Strikes Back of the season right here. Season, and it's definitely you saw that there. Big invasion failed, and see a lot of also the cunningness of Azula. Even when she doesn't even have her powers there, she's still able to fuck with Team Avatar.
She had the foresight to get a couple Dai Li guards from Ba Sing Se. She is very skilled with moving and evading and parkour, so she was giving them the work the entire time.
Again, shows how great Azula is, even when she doesn't have her fire bending abilities there. Good episode there. That's a good pick there, The Day of Black Sun. That's on my list as well. They're pretty high up. So I'm gonna go on to my number seven one here. Tim, you didn't give your number eight.
Mine was the Firebending Masters, season 3, episode 13. Zuko's just found out that he lacks firebending, because firebenders were told for 100 years fueled their bending with rage, and they've lost sight of the core tenets of their bending discipline. And so they go on this journey to find the original Firebender Masters, which Zuko says, well, the original ones were dragons, but everyone wiped them out. We find out Iroh found and spared the last two, as well as learned the actual dragon bending. And that is why he's the dragon of the West, because he's not powerful because he killed a dragon, but because he spared, he communed, he learned from it and respected it as the natural elemental progenitor of their bending discipline.
Mm.
And yeah. We see this whole Mesopotamian society of the sun that has been guarding these dragons too. I thought that was just another neat thing to add in there, because of course there would be a sun worshipping civilization in the Fire Nation.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah.
Hey, I like just kind of that shock of, not only because we've been told the entire thing is like, we've seen the Badgermoles, we've seen the sky bison, we've seen, the water serpents, and you know, the water bending comes from the moon, but we never actually seen that dragons were a thing in Avatar the Last Airbender.
Mm, yeah. And the show's very good at influencing real culture put into the show. You know, I think the show does a very good job at that, showing the dragons and how, you know, they form their style from the dragons. And you see the dragons continue on, because you see it in Korra as well. Zuko rides a dragon in Legend of Korra. So the dragons have now, you know, become a part of the firebending culture again. It's not a mission of the Fire Nation to just exterminate and to oppress everything around them and be the only dominant force there. We definitely see that. And you see the kind of the more bonding between Aang and Zuko, as well of them trying to learn the firebending again, and him being his firebending teacher, which was, I thought, also very good. But yeah, I mean, and to see them kind of mimic the firebending kind of movements there to resemble the form. They do a good job that later on in the episode of like, well, it looks like you're dancing, and he's like, it's not a dance, it's a, you know, fighting style. It's like, well, what's the fighting style called? He's like, oh, well, the dance of the dragons. That's what it's called.
Yeah, and not just that, also Aang is still carrying a lot of that trauma from the first time he tried learning firebending from Jon, and he wasn't emotionally ready for it, and he ended up burning Katara, and he's been carrying that guilt with him for like two seasons, and him overcoming that, it is very beautiful character writing.
Raymond Joe said, this is the way Eastern mythology dragons are cooler. This is why Eastern mythology dragons are cooler than Western mythology dragons there. Yeah.
You're right.
And since did George R. Martin steal the dance with dragons title from Avatar? I don't know, maybe. That'd be funny if he actually did. Maybe George R. Martin's a huge Avatar Last Airbender fan. He's like, man, I just love that show. But yeah, I mean, I really like that a lot there, how they did that. And this, like you said, this culture of Meso kind of people, Mesopotamian kind of people, that was very good. And saying that the fire is, it's like life, it's like a heartbeat, you know, it is, you know, kind of the birth there. And they have this, not just this some scary destructive force, which we saw when Aang was talking to the other firebending teacher that he was going to, that it's like he only had a destructive, he's like, firebending is only to destroy and kill and maim, not to actually bring life to things. So I thought that was good to show that fire actually does have a purpose there. It's not only for destruction and maiming people, which was very good. All right. So I'm going to go on to my seventh one here, since, yeah. All right. Which would be Jet. That is the episode here dealing with the roguish outlaw, as we see there. Katara catches feelings for this kind of person here. And this is kind of one of the first examples that we see of what the Fire Nation, of the examples of what it's done, kind of the people in its surrounding areas there. And we see that, you know, we learn of Jet's backstory, who is very anime inspired. The Jet character is very much based on like a Spike Spiegel from Cowboy Bebop. And he rolls around with a crew there of other kind of outlaws. They're fighting against the Fire Nation. And this is also a similar situation where we find with Hama, where they've been, their lives have been ruined and destroyed by the Fire Nation, and they're seeking revenge against the Fire Nation. And a lot of that seeking revenge is going against the citizens of the Fire Nation, and not that really people, too much of the government.
Yeah, yeah. And like you were saying with Hama, and Jet is basically a war criminal in this episode, and seeing the, and this was back in book one when the show was really still trying to find its legs as far as what it was trying to do story-wise. And here we're getting the first shades of not only the cruelty of the Fire Nation, but also how in that cruelty it can create monsters like Jet.
Yeah, and you see that. And the actor who they got to play him in the live action does look a lot like him, actually. They're pretty spot on, the actor that he got to play him, which was very good. But yeah, this was a kind of a strong episode of that. I know people are big defenders of Jet, just like Hama. People are like, hey, people don't think he did anything wrong. People are like, hey, this guy's justified in everything he did. Which I kind of see that a little bit, but yeah, I mean, maybe he goes a little bit too far, but you see that his village was burned down and killed, you know, his people were killed by the Fire Nation as a little boy. So he's grown up being in this fight and being in this war basically his entire life. He never got to be a kid there. What are your thoughts on this episode, Tim?
I think this episode goes, I didn't have it on my list, but it deserves to be on the list because it is, it's one of the first instances I think we come across a non-Fire Nation entity that is capable of just as much bad. If the road to hell is paved with good intentions, and you can see where his good intentions are. He wants to kill the Fire Nation, and you can see that as a result of his trauma, he is led to believe that this is the best course of action, that one dead firebender is worth anything. It's that loss of sight of good and evil, that moral ambiguity where you're asking yourself as an audience member, was Jet in the right? Was he evil? Would it have been worth it to wipe out because the Fire Nation were getting supplies there? Was it worth it? And the fact that a children's show in 2005 was able to make me question the moral ambiguity of killing a civilian population to wipe out the enemy things stationed there. It's fucking wild. It's a great episode. And even Katara is now led to believe just like, okay, my mom was killed by the Fire Nation, but I don't want to go about my revenge in this way. And that's
even the manipulation tactics that Jet uses on like Sokka. It's like, hey man, it's like, yeah, you and I, we're both leaders. We understand the need to make the hard call. It's like appealing to ego, appealing to pathos, appealing to logic. It's like all of it is beautifully showcased in this episode. And this didn't make my list, but it was a very tight call for crafting mine.
So what you got, Nick? What's your next episode there? Let's be your number 7.
Okay. Next episode on my list is the series season finale for Book 1, and that is Siege of the North, where I kind of have issues with the first season of Avatar The Last Airbender. It was kind of having a little bit of those first season jitters, but the build up into the finale with the Fire Nation invading the Northern Water Tribe, it was completely epic. You had some incredible character moments with the maturation of Sokka in this character, his dynamic with Princess Yue, getting to see more of the spirit world, seeing Zuko's coming of age, seeing his moments with Aang, and seeing Katara come into her own as a master waterbender, and also has one of the dopest finale action set pieces with Aang utilizing the ocean spirit to create that insanely enormous monster to wipe out that Fire Nation invasion force. It was awesome to see. And when I saw it for the first time when I was a kid on Nickelodeon, my little mind was blown.
Very strong episode. So Princess Yue sacrifices her life and becomes the new moon spirit.
That's nice, buddy.
Yeah, which was big. which was big there. The show did a lot of good gut punches in it, I thought, which was very good, and it didn't stray away from that too much. And that was very good there, seeing that, and seeing that the Fire Nation can still do damage to Team Avatar and do damage line and still be a legitimate threat without kind of undercutting them. So there's not a lot of moments where this Team Avatar wins all the time or is just dominating all the time.
Every fight comes with a cost, whether it be personal or whether it be emotional. And this one, even for as brief an appearance as Princess Yue had, you still feel her presence and how important she is to the characters on the show.
Tim, what are your thoughts?
I didn't have this on my list because I had the other two season finales on it, but I do think it was one of the sticking points where if somebody was on the fence about whether or not they were wanted to stick around the series, this was a good episode for that, because you get not just a victory, but a bitter victory. You see, it started off with Sokka noticing the soot in the snow, which is kind of a callback to the fact that he's a survivor of war, and he's bringing that knowledge to a culture that is dangerously unequipped to deal with war because it's been relatively isolated so long. And then Yue's death was bitter, but also knowing that the spirit kind of had an indication that this might happen at some point. She was essentially insurance. She knew she would have to give her life someday for the moon spirit. She just didn't know when. And it's kind of almost tragic in a way, because like her life was only like her getting any life at all was the gift from the spirit. And we see Zhao being dragged underneath the waves. Both sides lost somebody, but the Fire Nation's reaction to their losing a general, that was nothing. Or Admiral Zhao, then they didn't mind losing him at all. But Yue's loss was felt. They did not bat an eye, but Yue's loss was felt. And I think that's another way that they go to show how the two factions view life.
And not just how the factions view life, but the actual just devastation that war causes.
Oh yeah, that there is no winner in war. Both sides, or like the water tribe survived. Yeah, it didn't end the war. Somebody died. Several people probably died. And that's just it shows the devastation of war the day after when the waterbenders are trying to rebuild. But that pristine city that you were showed the wonders of at the beginning of the episode, they're all shattered and marred. Broken and melted, and it really drives home just the severity of full-scale open warfare. Fun little tidbit, though. We do see Admiral Zhao as a brief character in Korra in the Field of Lost Memories. He's wandered. There's this field where spirits can drag people, where they don't have any memory, and they're constantly lost to eternally wander this fog. And Admiral Zhao was wandering around. Yeah.
Liu Xiao.
Oh, shit.
Moonslayer, I will capture the Avatar. I am Zhao the Conqueror.
So he didn't just die. He was dragged to an eternity in hell.
Rightfully so.
The last airbender.
Oh, jeez.
I will still defeat you.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. That was still in there.
That man is in the throes of dementia.
Yeah. I mean, he's stuck in there for eternity. Yeah. And can never die. Just constantly just living in a loop his entire life. I mean, that's
the thing about the spirit world that's horrifying, is that like thousands of years could pass in what feels like 5 minutes in the actual world. So it's trippy going there.
All right, so I'm going to go on to my number 6-1, and that it would be The Library. That's the episode here. The Library was the episode in season 2, and the reason I really like this episode a lot is, and the plot of it is them trying to basically gain knowledge on how to defeat the Fire Nation Team Avatar. And what I really love about it, it feels very Hayao Miyazaki. It feels very something like that would kind of be there, especially with the owl creature that you have in the episode. Of like he's the guardian of the library, the one that kind of watches over it, very wary of humans, actually not even wary, just hates humans outright, and being there, doesn't trust them, and saying that they're always selfish, and that there is another member who came just to gain knowledge on how to kill other humans, was there. But I absolutely really love this episode a lot, of just because it feels so very much like a Hayao Miyazaki type thing. And this is also the episode we see that Appa, he got kidnapped. And we see kind of the value of Appa and how much he is a member of the team there and when he's gone. And we also see, like, speaking about Sokka, like, a lot of, like, his genius. We see that here of him figuring out of when the comet is, when the eclipse is going to come. And when that's kind of going to Firebender is not going to be able to use their abilities there, and that's a good time to be able to strike and to read the calendar
there. Yeah, and having the foresight to, wait, if there's another one coming, we just got to figure out when.
Yeah, which I thought was very, very good and very kind of well done there. And I think who voiced the owl?
The owl was voiced by Hector Elizondo, who's frequent Gary Marshall collaborator. He also did the voice of Bane on Batman, the animated series.
Which is very nice. And the owl does make an appearance in the live action TV show, which feels kind of like super early on, which was really kind of weird that the owl made an appearance there in the live action show there, because when Aang goes to like the spirit realm, the owl just shows up. Very kind of weird. But how do you guys feel about this episode of the library?
I think it's great as far as setting up stakes for later in the show, because the big takeaway in this was setting up the coming eclipse of this is when we can invade the Fire Nation and we can fight back, and setting up a ticking time bomb that I think was sort of lacking in this book where we had one in the first season, because like we said, was both a great thing about that is because we had an end goal in book one, and in book two, that end goal was kind of missing. And this is the episode where it gave us that. It was, we got to tell the Earth King about the eclipse and we have to find Appa.
And great battle they did with the owl too. And the one guy who was like the professor who was with them, he just stayed. And you see at the end of Korra, you see his corpse. He really did. When he said he loved books, he loved books. Because he stayed there till the day he died. There is that.
With him being dragged to the spirit world, it begs the question, how did he die? Because those who physically enter the spirit world, when they die, they just stay in the spirit world. They just lose the ability to leave it corporeally. Mm. So how did he starve to death there?
Well, in this, I think the library, it's kind of like this in between where it's not quite in the spirit world. It's just because like everything is corporeal there. It was like Aang still has all of his bending in there, which we're shown doesn't happen in the spirit world.
And you see what a badass Toph feels like lifting up, like still holding up the entire building there just with her powers there, which was very impressive there as well. Tim, what are your thoughts on the library?
I thought it was really, really interesting because they've had some encounters with great spirits, but this is one who prizes intelligence above all. And we see just we see the setting up of stakes. We see the Appa being lost and Toph having to make that decision between potentially losing everyone or fighting Appa. And we see that she's at a disadvantage in the desert altogether, and so she wouldn't have even been able to really fight them. So it was a hard thing. And the following episode, which didn't make my list either, but it was really compelling to see that tragedy and that loss. And that is set up by the library, which it's a phenomenal one. Seeing the library sunk, seeing somebody willing to stay behind with books because it was his life's goal. And Wan Shi Tong is not exactly wrong. Zhao did burn a giant chunk of the library. That's why so much of the library is underground to begin with. It's sunk under the sands to hide it away from people. That was Wan Shi Tong's kind of go-between of sinking the library almost all the way and just taking it all the way to the spirit world. And then he's Sokka's caught in a lie. And that is it. He drags that shit right to the spirit world and we find it in Korra. And that I love it. That they were able to tie back the library when they were actually in the spirit world.
That was my number six one. Nick, what do you got? Unless Nick is frozen. It might be frozen there. I'll give Nick a minute to come back. Tim, what's your sixth one?
Appa's Lost Days. Because I think it was phenomenal that they were able to do an episode without the main characters present for the vast majority of it. And I think it really highlighted animal cruelty in a way that you can show it to kids and they're going to be like, hey, that's fucked up. Maybe I shouldn't do animal cruelty. And not only that, but what happens to pets when they get lost and the harsh realities of the way the world treats animals, like the cruelty of a circus, the cruelty of wanting to own a creature that has a decent amount of intelligence. Like, but people will treat dogs like an absolutely subservient, but they are quite intelligent. And so they can understand the animosity that people will demonstrate to them in a way that a lion tamer demonstrates that exertion of will through violence. Mm-hmm. And then we also see at the very end of it, Azula with the Kyoshi warriors going into fighting them, and that the Kyoshi warriors were the ones that saved Appa and like got him cleaned up and sent him on his way. And so it's not even an episode that like goes through like that could just be entirely filler, because that knowledge of what happened to the Kyoshi warriors sets up what happens at the end of season 2 incredibly well. So Appa's Lost Days, I think, is a very good episode. It's an emotionally impactful one because, I know I definitely cried the first time I watched it. That was a sad fucking episode.
Yeah. You see him, he's getting abused in the circus. Yeah,
that is basically just a 20-minute emotional gut punch.
Yep.
No, I think not just getting emotionally abused at the circus, but, you know, having to be at the circus. Also, having to be at the circus. That's the most.
Oh, shit. Nick, I think going in and out there. Frozen again. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, really terrific episode there.
Damn it.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe try. You want to try restarting real quick? You try, maybe?
Yeah, give me.
Yeah. So Nick is going to restart there for a second. We caught up with him. But,
what did you think of Appa's Lost Days?
Yeah, strong episode, Appa's Lost Days. This wasn't on my list, but I'm glad you put it on your list. Good to talk about. Because, yeah, I mean, I think when Appa got kidnapped, it showed that he was really a character in the show and a valuable member to the team, and not just the cute animal sidekick and not just, like, the mode of transportation, which I think is also something missing from the live-action show of just, like, and I understand why they didn't want to put Appa in, because that's cost a lot of money, because he's purely just CGI, so it costs a lot of money to show him. But Appa does a lot. I mean, he, you know, saves their lives. He, you know, does feel like a very valuable member of the team. You know, he does have a certain level of intelligence there. So I think when he is gone, you really do feel that, and you do miss that. And when you see that, when Aang is reunited with Appa, that's so pivotal, and that's such an important moment. Like, a long friend has been gone. And then when Appa first went missing, like after the, I think it was after the episode of the library, the desert, I mean, mm-hmm. Aang just snapped. I mean, you know what I mean? He went full Avatar state, which we only seen him do once before, you know?
And we see the full, like, that's an excellent point, because that loss, he's feeling the loss of his people, because he only had Momo then left at that point. But Momo is somebody he met after the 100 years. Appa is the last person alive from that 100 years, to the point where shortly after Aang dies, Appa dies, as part of the canon for Legend of Korra. But it's just heart-wrenching. And that's why the library does set that up really good. But Appa's Lost Days really shows, like, yeah, we got to see Aang's grief, but we get to see the anguish of somebody who's separated from the rest of the people that he loves, because Appa is just a whole other little person.
Rayfim,
I'm a big person.
That one almost feels like a Grindy Tartaninsky came in to direct. He did famous shows, Samurai Jack. He did Primal, which I still want to see Primal. I haven't checked that out yet. I hear that's pretty amazing. Rayfim said it probably felt like when Appa was gone, his culture was gone too. Yeah.
Yeah.
He said, because, yeah, that's one of the last connections he has to his culture. I mean, the Sky Bison is one of the things there.
So this guy, the episode was actually directed by Giancarlo Volpe, who actually worked on King of the Hill, throughout, I believe, the entire run as an assistant director and storyboard artist. So, funny enough, just somebody coming in from King of the Hill is just like, let me write one of the most emotionally poignant episodes of Avatar.
Wow. And then this episode, like you mentioned, like Kyoshi Warriors come in, they find him, he's all beat up and battered and starving, and they come and clean him up and everything like that, which that was a very sweet moment there, and very good. Yeah, what's your thoughts, Nick, on Appa Lost Days there?
Oh, this is one of the most emotionally draining episodes of the show because of how heavy it is. It is impressive, and we talked about this when we were discussing the first two books, that you can have an episode that is following that, you have a character in the show with Appa who is nonverbal, but he still feels like such a massive presence in this show. And when he is missing for the latter half of book two, you feel that loss.
Very much so.
And a neat little point is that this was written by Elizabeth Ehaz, wife of Aaron Ehaz, the head writer. Or one of the head writers, and she was responsible for writing the Northern Air Temple, Return to Omashu, Zuko Alone, Avatar and the Fire Lord, Western Air Temple, and the Southern Raiders. She was also the story editor for Tales of Ba Sing Se, so she was the person responsible for making the stories work that the people wrote. She was responsible for writing the most emotionally. All the best solo episodes. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, very, very great work. Yeah, the guy looked it up. Yeah, and a lot of the kind of ones considered some of the greatest episodes of the series. Yeah, very nice.
Like half of the episodes that she wrote are on my list.
Wow. Yeah, so that was six here. Yeah, that was six. So, yeah, Nick, what about you?
Okay, my number six episode is Bitter Work. It's a book two episode. It's we finally have a little bit of lull in the action. So Aang, time to start learning how to earthbend. Oh, what's that? You suck at it? Tough titty, sugar twinkle toes. It's getting to see delve into this kind of mental block that Aang has with when it comes to earthbending, because the foundation of it is so completely counter to how Aang was raised and how culturally different he is. It's about Aang having to learn how to stand up for himself, which is very much inherent to earthbending, that it is sturdy. You have to stand your ground. You can't just find another way around it. But on the other side of it, you also have Zuko reunited with his uncle after Zuko Alone and trying to learn how to bend lightning. And failing that, learning how to redirect it. And Zuko's breakdown in this episode where he's like yelling to God in this light thunderstorm, and it's like, you never held back before, why stop now? And seeing how much grief and bitterness he is carrying, and Zuko is one of the best written characters I think in television history, and this is a fantastic episode to showcase that and also Aang's growth and development as the Avatar. It is also an episode that doesn't forget to be funny, with Sokka spending the most of the episode stuck in a hole in the ground.
You see that earthbending, you see this kind of earthbending is his natural opposite of an airbender. You see that, you saw that early on in season one where he was trying to learn from Bumi, where they had their little test and their little bout there. That a lot of airbending style is defense, you know, avoiding, you know, trying to look for the counter move instead of, as opposed to earthbending, is a lot more of the offense of trying to attack there first.
It's like we talk about with Cobra Kai, it's Miyagi-Do versus Cobra Kai.
Yeah, very true. Yeah. And you kind of see that kind of exemplified here. I think this wasn't on my list, but you do get to see of him kind of Aang learning earthbending. I mean, Tim, you would know more than me. So how long does it take Aang to actually learn all these other different elements? Like, is there an official time frame there?
By the end of the series, he actually hasn't officially mastered all the elements. I think it takes him 4 years or something. But he is still like the youngest to be a fully realized Avatar. Younger than Korra even. He does maintain as his mantle. And he also
had Roku who basically had like the ideal life of an Avatar. He learned when he was 16. He had like plenty of time to learn all the elements, and shit was mostly peaceful during his tenure.
Yeah. And it's that peace that allowed the ambitions of his closest friend to go unchecked, because it was the one person that he wasn't looking out for.
And we'll get into that later in this discussion, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
So let's go to my number five. And number five that we already discussed already that Tim did. And number five is the Tales of Bong Sik-Sik. Fabulous episode. Really love that one a lot. And who directed that episode? Let me see who directed that episode really quickly. Let's see here. Let's see. Ethan Spaulding directed it here. He also directed his Return to Omashu, Bitter Work, which was Nick's one as well. Mm. King, The Painted Lady, Avatar and the Fire, which is also on Nick's list as well. Nightmares mm-hmm. and Daydreams, The Western Air Temple, Sozin's Comet, which is on my list there. So he did a lot of really great ones there. And this was written by, let's see, you had the Joan Yasta and Lisa Wallander there, who did The Tale of Toph and Katara. And The Tale of Iroh was written by Andrew Hubert. And then The Tale of Aang was written by Gary Shippick. And The Tale of Sokka was written by Lauren Macklin. And then The Tale of Zuko was written by Katie Matala, who also written that one. And The Tale of Momo was Justin Ridge and Gina Carlo Volo, who wrote that one there. So they wrote that one. So that was my number five there. What about you, Tim? What you got for number five?
Just before I forget, one of the things with the elementing thing, just of the Bitter Work, Bagua that airbending is based off of is actually based off of those circular movements and never having a solid stance. And I think it's Southern Hungar that is the bending practice martial art equivalent, and that is based entirely off of having a very solid, immovable stance. And that they transferred that into the lore of the series is exceptionally well, because it's carried over even into Kyoshi, who uses her fans because she was a shitty airbender.
Oh, Kyoshi was a shitty airbender. That was the, so
it does... very shitty airbender, and her mother was an airbender too, which makes it even funnier.
Mm. So do avatars usually have one element they're the weakest in out of everything?
That's usually the opposite of their one on the wheel, but Korra showed that it's not actually, it's the one that most opposes your personality style. And mm-hmm. hers, she could not do airbender because personality wise she's a fucking earthbender.
Mm. Okay. What about you, Tim? What you got for number five there, man?
Sokka's Master is going to be my number five, though. That one is one where we see the seeds of what is talked about, or what becomes the first season of Korra, with non-benders feeling inadequate next to the immense change mm-hmm. that benders are able to affect. And he finds a master, a true swords master. Mm-hmm. And they did actually have a sword master doing the choreography for this sword fight and doing teaching them, like the writers, like, all right, we're going to have him teach Sokka how to be a sword fighter. What are actual things that you want to learn as a sword fighter? And so this mm-hmm. is actual choreography that was followed for the animation. And it was incredibly well done. It sets up Sokka to be a fully realized fighter on par with the other benders, because as long as he has this prowess in, like he's a brilliant person, he's a strategist, and using the master allows him to like think quick on his feet. Like you're seeing here, he's utilizing his environment to attack after only what, a few days of instruction.
Using his superior speed, using the elevation, using little tricks to try and get over on an older opponent. It's all stuff that I think is really well done. And if because I don't think the show, even if Sokka and the characters kind of treated him as the kind of goofy comic relief, I don't think the show ever really went out of their way to portray him as such. In this episode, it's really affirming that, yeah, Sokka is this vital part of the group. He is the brains of it. He is the guy who is creative. He always thinks of solutions that aren't out
there. Uh-oh.
That are,
I think he messed
up.
He's back. Okay.
Outside of conventional thinking.
Yeah, you just cut up
down to like the material that Sokka chooses to make his.
With a meteorite sword, a non-conventional weapon as non-conventional as his way of thinking.
Yeah. Oh, okay, Nick is gonna come back there, but yeah, as Tim finished for Nick there, the meteorite sword there that he has. Did Sokka basically carry on the swordsmanship later on there?
He was a capable sword fighter, capable tactician and investigator, and we see in the comics after the series he puts more of his perceptive and intuitive thinking skills to work, and he actually becomes an investigator for a bit. And as Republic City is settled, he focuses on he works quite closely with Toph, who goes into criminal justice and starting the Metal Bending Police Academy. But we also see Sokka as like an actual lawyer, because he's not just about investigating and putting people in jail. He's about figuring out the nuances of case. He's about pursuing justice using all of the facts that he's presented with. And it's really kind of cool how they develop his character. He wears a multitude of hats. And while he's a very capable warrior post-war, he's also able to fit into a role where he's able to help society just in a different way.
Mm. Oh, very nice there. Let's see. I'll give Nick a minute here. I'll come back to him with his fifth one because he's on that one. But my number four would be the Crossroads of Destiny. Would be my number fourth one here. Really, really, again, like a lot of the episodes of the series, really, really terrific episode. Liked it quite a bit. And Nick is gonna come back pretty soon here, but let me look up who directed this episode here, the Crossroads of Destiny here. And this was the episode where we saw like Azula, and then she almost kills Aang there with her bolt of lightning, and that was such a dramatic moment in the series. Like, really, like your heart dropped, I mean, into your stomach, I mean, when you saw this, especially because I believe it was in this episode as well where we learned about the information that if you die.
Episode prior with the guru
that if you die in the Avatar state, then that's it. You know what I mean? There will be no more Avatars ever again after that. With that,
actually, wait, that's expertly set up in the first episode of season two when they're trying to trigger the the Avatar state is the name of the episode, and they're trying to trigger it, and they're just like, oh, if we can put you in the Avatar state, we'll just have you fight the Fire Lord. Bing, bang, boom. And they're like, well, actually, if he dies in the Avatar state, that's it.
Mm.
No more.
No more Avatars after that. And the action sequences here are really incredible, too, especially Azula and Zuko. And this is like the turn of, like, you see Zuko. It's like you think that once he was good and you think he's all settled, he's like, okay, maybe he's going to make a turn. He kind of, you know, reverses back and becomes the evil Zuko again. And this was the moment Katara really, you know, started to really hate Zuko even more so than she already did, because when he tries to integrate himself into Team Avatar, she brings up this moment and that way he betrayed the team and joined the side of Azula in fighting her and Aang, which was, yeah, devastating for her. So she really has a big resentment for him against that. But really, really great choreography here amongst the stuff with the bending and the action, the duel there between the both of them. What's some of the things you love about this episode there?
Well, one of the things about the choreography is that every time you see the choreography, they actually do have martial art masters doing and making the choreography for these fights that the animators are then going and then animating. So it's I have to hand it to anybody who is interested in it. Go look up the names of these people. They do tremendous work in motion capturing. But the emotional impact of having Aang walking alongside Iroh, of having Katara stuck with Zuko and having that conversation where they're bonding over their trauma, over their shared loss, over how they both lost a mother. We see the betrayal of Zuko and how hurt Katara feels because she bonded with him over that trauma, and he still chose to attack them over that chance of being with his family, or just, he's willing to do anything on to join his family, and because he had still not learned his lesson. And the Crossroads of Destiny is absolutely correct, because at this point Aang died in the Avatar state, his connection to the past lives was severed. And he was healed with water from a spirit oasis is the reason that he's allegedly he was able to maintain the connection, because it healed Rava in enough that it didn't disrupt the cycle or whatever. And Korra was sadly lacking in spirit oasis juice. I think seeing everyone come together, I think Iroh communicating with people and giving these really sage lessons of wisdom, I think that was really cool to see. And having him kind of actually turn against Zuko and be like, no, I'm not siding with you. We're not going home. This is wrong.
And this was directed by Aaron Ehas. I mean, it's written by him, and then directed by Dante DiMatteo, one of the creators of the series. I love, I mean, when you saw that finale of I mean, we saw the ending of this Azula taking him down, that was like I said, big moment of there, and it presented her as even more of a threat than she already was. You see, like, and this was in season two, where she kind of took over more of the duties of hunting the Avatar as opposed to Zuko, and how kind of if she had did that from probably season one, then there would probably be no Team Avatar. If she was, I mean, if she did it from season one, there
highly and, effective hunter.
Yeah, and you see with Iroh, he's the one that helped Aang and Katara escape. I mean, he kind of fended off the other warriors there.
He's been doing that in a way since, you'll notice at the beginning of the season one, when they're seeing, he's like trying to convince Zuko, it's just the celestial lights, just don't even bother pursuing it. He's been with Zuko this whole time, trying to dissuade him of his notions of honor and trying to go back to his family. He's trying to help Zuko move on. He's trying to impede his search for the Avatar. And then the whole time when he is hunting the Avatar, you can tell Iroh is half-assing it. He's at the market. He's playing Sungi Horn. He's taking a nap.
Drinking tea.
Exactly. Ultimately, he just wants to open a fucking tea shop. And that they give him that at the end of the series. Chef's kiss. I couldn't have asked for more.
Yeah. What do you got for number four?
Four was actually the Crossroads of Destiny.
Oh.
but since we just got to talk about it, the Guru, I will bring up real quick. That was the one where we're fully educated on what the Avatar state is. And we're actually given a lesson that, if anyone's familiar with chakral meditation and the idea of chakras, they're borrowing all of these ideas from Hindu and Buddhist and Taoist mythologies, but chakral meditation is actually a thing that you can learn by watching this episode. Clearing the pathways by clearing your mind of certain thoughts and learning to reframe your mind within the scope of that meditation is how chakral meditation works. So that he's teaching him this meditation specifically because it's clearing the energy pathways that is used as a bender. I thought that was absolutely genius. And that he was talking with Guru Patik, which was a friend of Monk Gyatso. So he was actually learning it from one of the last surviving people from his childhood. And I thought that was also really neat, because he couldn't learn from an airbender. At least he got to learn from a guru who learned from the airbenders.
So you said your number. What was your number three then?
Avatar and the Fire Lord was number three for me. Okay. Because it's at that point, that episode, we learn that Aang and Zuko are related. They're cousins. I want to say they're like second cousins. But they seeing Roku's life played out is something that we got to see with Avatar Wan, and I would have arguably taken another episode following him as an adult or some shit, because it was really cool to get to see the this other age and seeing what should have been, what the Avatar life cycle should be like, which is that coming of age, the mastering the four elements, and we see Sozin's betrayal to pursue the colonies, and we see the like the rebuffment of Roku's mercy, and seeing Roku's dragon that he's flying around on, because we get to see him a little bit in the Spirit World episodes in season one, think the Winter Solstice part 1 and 2, but getting to see his whole life as well as the context of what started the 100-Year War, because this is the episode where we find out what starts the war, why it started, what the original goals were, which was he wanted to share the Fire Nation's prosperity, but he was kind of warped in it because he was willing to kill his friend. And once he was willing to kill his friend, he was, it's one thing to just go someplace where it's uninhabited and start some colonies. It's another thing entirely to let your best friend die and then to figure out, shit, all right, my best friend's dead. Okay, you can tell that the invasion of the Fire or the Air Nation was almost a little bit kind of like an unhinged response. Like, he's like, shit, we just killed the Avatar. He's going to be born into the Air Nation now. So he spends 10 years playing there, or 12 years planning this invasion, because Aang is born right away, and the Air Nation isn't wiped out until like right before Aang goes into that iceberg.
Yeah, because like Avatar, when the Avatar dies, the next Avatar is born, what, 1 week later, right? After
It's like immediately. Rava goes into the next like into the next child being born of a child in the next cycle. So it's basically however long it takes Rava fly to the next body.
Okay. And you see, this is when because, and then a lot of Avatars live to be pretty old. They live to be pretty long age there, pretty much typically, right?
Yeah. There are varying degrees of long livedness. Some live fairly short, like Korok lived to be only like 34 or something. But that was because his soul had been attacked by a spirit. And and then Aang dies at like 67, also because his spirit was weakened from being in the Avatar state for 100 years. But then you also have Kyoshi, who learned the secrets of immortality from an assassin who was like 500 years old or something, this immortal old dude. And she only chose to die because she was like, look, I'm dead, my grandchildren are dead, I'm done, my wife's dead, it's over, I'm good. It's been 230 years. But yeah, Kyoshi was functionally immortal and only died because she chose to, and also because she noticed the Dai Li were all like, she'd founded them in her lifetime and then lived long enough to see the corruption of that organization.
Rafe Michaud, it's kind of weird how similar the rule of Avatar being reborn is to the Slayers in Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
That's because they're both stealing the idea from the idea of reincarnation, specifically with like the Dalai Lama, which is one thing that the Airbenders do, that is how they pick the new Avatar based off of the ritual that the Tibetans use to choose the next Dalai Lama.
Yeah. And that was also, speaking of King of the Hill, that was an episode of King of the Hill where Bobby, they tried to decide whether or not he was going to be the next Dalai Lama there. I remember.
Yep. Putting the objects before him, and then he just chooses the random objects, and they're just like, oh, it's him.
But yeah, this is wonderful that you had this episode. I always love seeing episodes where they kind of give backstory to the Avatars, the past ones there. Like in episode core, where they did the episode of the very, very first Avatar. I love that episode. And then seeing that, so the Fire Lord Roku, the Avatar that was rightly directly before Aang, he had a wife, and he gave birth to Zuko's mother, right? Or his grandmother.
Right? Was Zuko's mother. Grandmother, yeah.
Grandmother. So yeah, I guess that would make, Aang kind of had third cousins, I guess, a little bit, and to some degree there. So it's like, did you think that made Zuko a little like, trying to make him too special, of like, he comes from great evil and then great good, because his, father was, his grandfather was Sozin, and then also, but his also grandfather was also Roku.
Avatar. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I guess Aang is cousins in that way, and that he's like, Roku was him, but Roku was also Zuko's grandfather. So it's kind of, I think that's another one way the show uses to show that Zuko is equally capable of good and evil. He goes to that archive to find out the nature of his roots, and he finds out that both his roots are both Fire Nation and Avatar. And so you find him just fucking yelling out in fury in that, because he's torn as to his character, and for good fucking reason.
Rain from Tree says, never would have expected Bobby being a prop comedy to come in clutch like that. And that was a fun episode too. Yeah, I mean, the way it kind of ends was, I think if I remember correctly, like, he does pick the right object, but he picked Connie in the episode. It's kind of like the monks was like, it's a tough call, but I ended up making the decision. He didn't really pick the object, so I'm gonna, kind of tough call there. And he also says, kind of like when they made Peter Parker's parents retroactively S.H.I.E.L.D. agents assassinated by the Rose Guild, takes away from the normalcy of the character just a little for me. In reference to Zuko there, trying to make him like his grandfather was the Avatar. Love it for him. And then number three for me in the episode, we already talked about this, the Siege of the North. That was one of your best episodes, right?
I did not have that on my list because I also had Crossroads, and I also have Sozin's Comet on there. Which is four episodes in one, so I feel like I'm cheating.
I think Nick already did that one, so I already did that one. Number two, then we'll go to this one. Then, this is probably considered one of the best episodes of the entire series. A lot of people rave about it. It will be Zuko Alone. Zuko Alone is pretty much telling the backstory of Zuko. And Zuko is probably for a lot of people the most well written character in the entire show. Some people even think have one of the best arcs in TV show history, just the way they do it, the way they write it. You could see, like, you know, a lot of the episode details him going to this, like, this Earth village that's been occupied by the Fire Nation. He kind of bonds with this boy, and you kind of see he sees the horrors of what the Fire Nation has done, and sees, like, these people have a similar backstory to him, especially this family that's been ruined by war, and kind of them losing a son, because much like how Iroh lost a son in the war, they have also done that. Really terrific episode, just on every note. I mean, it's pretty much a perfect episode. I mean, you can't really get better than this. And this was written, this was by Elizabeth Welch, and then this was written by Lauren McElmoon. And I mean, huge, great job from her as well. Yeah, and this was a story about Michael DiMartino and Brian Canetzo there. What's your thoughts on Zuko Alone?
I think it's phenomenal because, I agree, Zuko is one of the most well-written character arcs in, at least that I've seen, just because it shows his childhood, it shows his mother leaving, it shows his father, it shows why his mother left, with the likelihood that his mother assassinated somebody. And it shows... just like how ostracized and alienated he was from his father, and how disconnected he always felt from his people in a way, because he had the kindness of his mother. But you also see him trying to move past that, trying to be more than just a Fire Nation soldier, trying to be more than just a Fire Nation prince. He just wanted to be helpful. And everywhere he went, he saw the ire that being a firebender drew. And the thing is, he couldn't even fault the people for it.